Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about Voltaire reading from the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophers on the Internet. This is a typical Internet resource, which is put up there and edited, sort of unlike references you have, hard copy references, which go out of date or need to be revised. This is continuously revised. Now, that being said, it has some good points and some bad points. Some good points in that it hangs together philosopher to philosopher. It's a good coherent story of the philosophers. It misses out some things. So in some philosophers, their impact on science or their impact, various other impacts are left wanting. So there's something you pick up there, but it's generally a very good read. So we've listened to the life of Voltaire, who basically is a bit of he's an outlaw, combination of James Bond and stuff like that. I've gotten the name of this actor. M said you go in, you shake things up, you disrupt things, and you shake things up, and then you leave. And so that's what Voltaire has done, and in sort of epic ways, he gets himself thrown out of Paris, London, Berlin, and eventually gets a chateau in the countryside of Switzerland, overlooking Paris, being able to escape the French guards who want to get him. He's sort of like the king, self-appointed poet, playwright, king of the Enlightenment. Incredible read. Sort of a love story in there as well. Everything happening. And basically he's just an outlaw at heart. And in a certain sense, although he has said that the kings aren't all that powerful, there's the agent of reason. He says that kings are actually necessary for the average person, the bloke in the street, the bloke behind the plough. They need a king. The rest of us, we fantastic people, we intellectuals, we don't need so much a king. And sort of this is sowing the seed of the American Revolution. And as I've sort of detected, or commentary here, foreshadowed Karl Marx. Now, going on to I've forgotten what the 2.1 was. Let's see if I can see what 2.1 was. Fighting for the... So he set up these mock battles and won them. Liberty. Yeah, so the idea of liberty was 2.1, but he would set up these mock battles and draw people into his fire. And in a sense, people responding to him actually were shaped by his pen. It's sort of a pretty amazing thing to think about. So he's a philosopher, or he's basically moved philosophy from a commentator to actually part of the machinery of life. There's other philosophers here. There's Newton, who's a bit of an English person, but now much more mysterious than I've ever thought of before, rather than just a boffin that everyone wrote out about. He's a central political movement. Basically all he said was, look, there's mathematical laws operating things. Don't ask me how. These are the laws, which was sort of a bit of a revolution. And this set up all this resonance between Leibniz, Kant. So Leibniz is a kraut, associated with one, the Hanoverian court. There's Kant, who's in what is naturally a piece of Germany underneath the Baltic Sea, even though Germany doesn't extend that far nowadays. You've got all these people sort of responding to Newton. So it's, if you can see that Newton was pre-Enlightenment, or the start of the Enlightenment, and then Newton created all this fuss and bother, but I don't think he was really... It'll be interesting to read the philosophical aspects of Newton. Newton took more things at a more personal grassroots level. He really disliked Descartes. It was a bit of an overbearing thing. I personally don't really like Hume. Voltaire is full of French style. So we go up to 2.2, hedonism. So that means having it's hard to imagine being a dad in a very sensible job or sensible lifestyle up here in Australia, what hedonistic stuff is, because I find it boring. Hedonism would be enjoying wine, but I suppose getting a little bit drunk and laughing and all that type of stuff and enjoying the good life. Hedonistic would say going to those exclusive clubs and shopping. I don't know how you get hedonistic nowadays in such a fantastic environment. Like, we've got beautiful, let's say out here in Australia, beautiful wildlife, beautiful food. It's all quiet, there's no crime. It's hard to see. But let's listen to what his idea of hedonism is. Voltaire's notion of liberty also anchored his hedonistic morality, another key feature of Voltaire's Enlightenment of philosophy. So, I hope it's not a wealth doctrine, a shopping doctrine, or a consumerist doctrine. One vehicle for this philosophy was Voltaire's salacious poetry, a genre that both reflects in his eroticism and sexual innuendo the lived culture of libertarianism that was an important feature of Voltaire's biography. Now, it's interesting, this sort of sexual thing, how it sort of played out with Lord Davy, and this underpinning. It's really interesting to see how it comes out. So for me, in terms of science, we've got Lord Davy and Faraday, the sort of sexually supercharged Davy, and the plotting Faraday next to each other, and what we put forward. And then you've got amperes. Amperes, it sounds like the current, so it's actually the bloke ampere and his marriage and how that played out. That's something to really, it's interesting to look at this. But Voltaire also contributed to the philosophical libertinism and hedonism through his celebration of moral freedom through sexual liberty. Voltaire's avowed hedonism became a central feature of his wider philosophical identity, since libertine writings and conduct were also invoked by those who wanted to indict him for being a reckless subversive devoted to undermining legitimate social order. Well, yeah. I mean, we've got the sort of the hard aspect of child exploitation, the exploitation side of it. Voltaire's refusal to defer to such charges and his rigour in opposing them through the defence of his very libertarianism that was used against him also injected a positive philosophical programme into the public struggles that was very influential. In particular, through his cultivation of a happy libertine persona. God, he would just be sick-inducing if I met him, I'm sure. And his application of philosophical reason towards the moral defence of this identity, often through the widely accessible vehicles of poetry and witty prose. Oh, witty. You are such a wit, Voltaire. Voltaire became a leading force in the wider Enlightenment articulation of morality grounded in the positive valuation of personal, especially bodily pleasure, and ethics rooted in the hedonistic calculus of maximising pleasure and minimising pain. Isn't that beautiful? So reducing it to pleasure and pain. It's, you know what? I really do think materialism and making profit at all costs and evaluating yourself and your evaluation worth just really sucks off fun out of society. He also advanced this cause by sustaining an unending attack upon the repressive and, to his mind, anti-human demands of the traditional Christian asceticism, especially priestly celibacy, and the moral codes of sexual restraint and bodily self abnegation that were still central to traditional moral teachings of the day. Okay, this same hedonistic ethics was also crucial to the development of a liberal political economy during the Enlightenment, and Voltaire applied his own libertinism towards this project as well. In the wake of the scandals triggered by Mandeville's infamous argument in The Fable of the Bees, a poem that should be remembered, that is in pursuit of private vice, namely greed, leads to public benefits, namely economic prosperity, a French debate about the value of luxury as a moral good erupted that drew Voltaire's pen. So this is like the trickle down. Trump, I'm just going to give my billionaires more billions of dollars. They just won't be able to hold it. It'll just split out of their hands. In the 1730s, he drafted a poem called, I love that, he drafted a poem, Le Moudin, that celebrated hedonistic worldly living as a positive force of society and not as the corrupting element of traditional Christian morality held to be. The only problem is that the people who are Christian, there's some good Christians, but there's a lot of two-faced people. People who go on, I expect loyalty, and they're really pretty crooked people. In his essay, Sur les Mœurs, it assumes he can speak French, essay on the whatever, M-O-E-U-S, he joined with other Enlightenment historians celebrating the role of material acquisition and the commerce in advancing the progress of civilization, which is this locky, this lock. If you happen upon a resource, you can exploit it, but you've got to not destroy the resource. There's locking economics. Let's see. Adam Smith. I was about to talk about Adam Smith. Adam Smith would famously make similar arguments in his founding of his tract of Enlightenment, Liberalization on the Wealth of Nations, published in 1776, which I think is Voltaire's death. Voltaire was certainly no great contributor to the political economic science that Smith practiced, but he did contribute to a wider philosophical campaign that made the concepts of liberty and hedonistic morality central to their work, both widely known and more generally accepted. It's just, it's sort of like, I don't know, it's people sort of dress up exploitation in hedonistic clothes, in my opinion. So it's this idea of, let's have a bet on the sports. Sports hedonism. It's interesting that there's sports philosophy in there. I was trying to concentrate myself out because I think we've got hedonism here and we've got sort of hedonism for the general population is that sports. Go on, have a bet, have a flutter. Everyone have a good old drink. The ineradicable good of personal and philosophical liberty is arguably the master theme of Voltaire's philosophy. And if it is, then two other themes are closely related to it. One is the importance of skepticism, and the second is the importance of the empirical science as a solvent to dogmatism and pernicious authority it engenders. Well, there you go. People shouldn't. I think, in my case, look at gathering of evidence as if you're making judgment in the process of making gathering evidence is a bit whacko. Okay, skepticism 2.3. I know what I mean by that. Often when I say I'm interested in so-and-so, people say, I think there's an actor I was interested in called Diana Durbin, simply because she was she's an okay actor, but some of the roles were awful, and often in old British World War II films that were produced during the Blitz and stuff like that, they wouldn't have enough money for Diana Durbin. So I remember a few of these films, and they'd say, Diana Durbin is coming, and coming to the set, and she never arrived, or she might make a little cameo at the end of something. So she was a US soldier pinup. And of course, I had picked up all the sexual innuendos of Diana Durbin, so I got canned for it. And I'll probably get canned for it by saying, look, I'm really interested in Voltaire, and people look at all the sex aspect of it. Okay, but Voltaire's a skeptic, a skeptical sexual fiend, the sort of things that we sort of rather love. Voltaire's skepticism descended directly from the Neo-Proyenthian revival of the Renaissance. So what does that mean? You know what, my memory's going to fail me, I'm just going to be able to... I can't remember Bacon's book, Bacon's sci-fi classic. A Sea Odyssey. It would be... given when it was written, when did Bacon die? It would be 1801, A Sea Odyssey. Yeah, it could be A Sea Odyssey. Revival owes the debt, in particular, to Montaigne, whose essays wedded the stance of doubt with the positive construction of self-grounded philosophical skepticism. Pierre Bailey's skepticism was equally influential in what Voltaire shared with these forerunners and what separated him from other strains of skepticism, such as the ones manifest in Descartes, in terms of, like, he was skeptical, so he had the mind-body separation. Descartes? Mind over matter. This is Descartes. I think, therefore I am. Is instance upon the value of skeptical position in its own right as a final and complete philosophical stance. That's right, Buck. That's where I stand. You should just be skepticism as the fundamental philosophical tool, not a way of life or abortionist. Among the philosophical tendencies that Voltaire most employed, in fact, were those that he associated with most powerfully with Descartes, who, he believed, began in skepticism but then left it behind in the name of some positive philosophical project designed to eradicate or resolve it. Which is true, because Descartes essentially reasoned that there must be God and all that type of stuff. So I would agree with him on that. So Descartes said, you know, if there is God, therefore, he was still hadn't really broken through into the Enlightenment. Such urges usually led to the production of what Voltaire liked to call philosophical romances, which, to say, systematic accounts that overcome doubt by appealing to the imagination and its need for coherent explanations. Well, I would say so, eventually, Descartes, but Descartes sort of knew it himself. He said that something to be true has to feel true, has to be simple, cut through truth. That's what truth is. And obviously, if you did any sort of self-examination, that's ridiculous. Such explanation, Voltaire argued, are fictions, not philosophy, and the philosopher needs to recognize that very often the most philosophical explanation of all is to offer no explanation at all. Isn't that beautiful? Such skepticism, often attacked as a bulwark of Voltaire's defense of liberty, since he argued that no authority, no matter how sacred, should be immune to the challenge of critical reason. Which sort of Locke was halfway through there, because you want your authority to be set up and then reasoned. You want to have skepticism up to the point that you're in charge, I would say. Voltaire's view on religion is, as manifest in his private writings, are complex. And based on evidence of these texts, it could be wrong to call Voltaire an atheist or even anti-Christian, so long as one accepts a broad understanding of what Christianity can entail. But even his personal religious views were subtle. Voltaire was unwavering in his hostility to church authority and the power of the clergy. Good old Jesuit trainee. For similar reasons, he also grew, as he matured, ever more hostile towards the sacred mysteries upon which monarchs of the old regime, aristocratic society, based on their authority. You know, I don't know if you've watched The Crown, this is just whack. The current British monarchy is just whack. Now, in these cases, Voltaire's scepticism was harnessed to his libertarian convictions through his continual effort to use critical reason as a solvent for these superstitions and the authority they anchored. I love the idea of using reason. I'm just going to look at what you've said, and we're going to apply reason to it and dissolve it. Yeah, isn't that beautiful? The philosophical authority of the romances such as Descartes, Malebranche and Leibniz, that's actually quite a good thing, that Descartes, Leibniz was definitely whack romancer. Descartes was a bit, there was a lot there, but he had romantic beginnings and ends. That's what's sort of so nice about him. But, I don't know, somehow I wouldn't put Descartes in the same as Leibniz. And here one sees how the defense of skepticism and liberty, more than deeply held opposition to religiosity per se, was often the most powerful motivator for Voltaire. From this perspective, Voltaire might fruitfully be compared with Socrates and other founding figures in Western philosophy who made a refusal to claim systematic philosophical positions a central feature of his philosophical identity. And that's right. Socrates and Plato didn't. Plato would just have people discussing it. Socrates' repeated assertion that he knew nothing was echoed in Voltaire's insistence that the true philosopher is one who declares there's not to know, and then has the courage to admit his ignorance publicly. Voltaire was also, like Socrates, a public critic and controversialist who defined philosophy primarily in terms of its power to liberate individuals from domination of the hands of authoritarian dogmatism and irrational prejudice. But Socrates had to kill himself at the end. So Socrates is this ancient Greek, 500-ish. BC, a good while before. Yet, while Socrates champions rigorous philosophical dialectic as an agent for an emancipation, Voltaire saw this same dialectical rationalism, that's argued reasoned rationalism, at the heart of the dogmatism that his thought overcome. That's an interesting sentence. So, this rationalism is getting in the way. Voltaire often used satire, mockery, and wit to undermine the alleged rigour of philosophical dialectic. And while Socrates saw this kind of rhetorical wordplay as a very essence of erroneous sophism that he sought to alleviate, Voltaire cultivated linguistic cleverness as a solvent to the false, deceptive dialectic that anchored the traditional philosophy. Okay, so that's a subtle point. But it's hard to, I think we've sort of that's imbued now with the stand-up comedians who parody things. So I think a lot of these things are going through. 2.4, Newtonian empirical science. So Newton had the equations, Locke and Bacon had the actual empirical inductive reasoning to come in. So it's not an individual person, I think it's a general movement to empiricism. Against the acceptance of ignorance that rigorous scepticism often demanded, and against the false escape from it found in sophistical knowledge, or what Voltaire called imaginative philosophical romances. Oh. Yeah, I think I love that. Voltaire offered a different solution than the rigorous dialectical reasoning of Socrates, namely the power and value of careful empirical science. Here one sees the debt that Voltaire owed to the currents of Newtonianism that played such a strong role in launching his career. To be fair to say, Newton did, when you read his Principia, and it's sort of like boring as batshit, some of it to read, I then constructed a wooden box and set it in motion, blah, blah, blah. And then some of the things are so, would you just write it as an equation? Isaac?
come on, Isaac. But he did do experiments. He did, if he thought something, he would do a little experiment. He didn't do what we would call, you know, it would probably give him a C nowadays if he did the same experiments in class. Now, Voltaire's own critical discourse against imaginative philosophical romances originated, in fact, with the English and Dutch Newtonians, many of whom were expatriate French Huguenots. So Huguenots are the... Sorry for mispronouncing it. In Australia, we've never heard it pronounced properly. So everyone goes, hey, Huguenot. You should listen to some of the classrooms, some of the things that we wreck your words about. They were Protestants who developed these tropes as rhetorical weapons in their battles with Lebanese and European Cartesians who engaged in the innovations of Newtonian natural philosophy. In his Principia Mathematica, Newton had offered a complete mathematical and empirical description of how celestial and terrestrial bodies behave. Yet, when asked to explain how the bodies were able to act in a way that he mathematically and empirically demonstrated that they did, Newton famously replied, "I feign no hypothesis." Isn't that beautiful? And he didn't, because he actually believed, this is amazing, he said, "That's what I do. Can you explain it to me, Newton?" "I feign no hypothesis. I provide no hypothesis for it." You had to obviously wait to Einstein and general relativity to tease it out. And it, even, dare I say, the CERN super collider in 2012 to get the Higgs boson, you need to get it all out. So it, up to that point, it's either God or it's this, and then God, you can cue behind it. He just believed it was God. From the perspective of traditional natural philosophy, this was tantamount to hand-waving, since offering rigorous causal accounts of nature of bodies in motion was the very essence of this branch of science. Newton's major philosophical innovation rested, however, in challenging this very epistemological foundation, an assertion that defence of Newton's position against the many critics, not least by Voltaire, became arguably the central dynamic of the philosophical challenge in the first half of the 18th century. Which is true. So this is why Descartes is actually closer to general relativity, because he's said, look, there is a mechanism behind it. Weird mechanism, but, you know, strangely he's got a little bit of a correspondence with quantum mechanics and stuff like that. So, it's an interesting thing to think about. While Newtonian epistemology, I offer no hypothesis. What did he say? What did Newton say? Just see if I can. I proffer no hypothesis. I feign no hypothesis. Which is, you know, spot on, mate-o. Which is one of the weirdo things in terms of, it's sort of, this hypothesis is not in the line of a true hypothesis, which is a prediction. It's really confused, because a hypothesis is, I expect such and such a pattern. End of story. No explanation for it. And then, you then see when this happens, you say, well, then this has its significance. It's really difficult when you get through. While Newtonian epistemology admitted of many variations, at its core rested a new scepticism about the validity of a priori rationalist accounts of the nature, and a new assertion of brute empirical fact as a valid philosophical understanding in its own right. Oh well. European natural philosophers, and therefore you get Kant trying to do it, and Kant actually made big headway in magnetism and whole lots of natural philosophy by doing it, fighting back. And Einstein actually move the two together. European natural philosophers in the second half of the 17th century, which is 1650 to 1700, had thrown out the metaphysics and physics of Aristotle, with its four-part causality and teleological understanding of bodies, motion, and cosmic order. So the four-part causality is the first cause, second, third, second and fourth cause. The first cause is matter, then the form, the shape, it fills in what it wants to do and what you want it to do. And that's sort of weird, but it means that you can bundle up any argument you want with them. Okay. As placed, however, a new mechanical causality was introduced that attempted to explain the world in equally comprehensible terms through mechanisms of inert matter acting by direct contact and action alone. The approach led to a vortical account of celestial mechanics, a view that held material bodies to be swimming in an ethereal sea, whose action pushed and pulled objects in the matter we observe. Well, that was not Newton, that was Descartes. So what are you going here? Why are they saying that? I don't quite understand. I think they may have made a big mistake here. Well, let's read. What could not be observed, however, was the ethereal sea itself, or other agents of this supposedly incomprehensive mechanical cosmos. Yet rationality nevertheless dictated that such mechanisms must exist, since without them philosophy would be returned to the occult causes of the historical and natural tendencies of the teleological principles. Bringing out these point contact mechanisms were how they worked was, therefore, the charge of the new mechanical philosophy of the late 17th centuries. Figures such as Descartes, Huygens and Leibniz established their scientific reputation through efforts to realize this goal. Now, Huygens is the wave particles. We still use this ancient thing, which is chucked out for optics, diffraction, wave particles. And I think this debate just really hasn't resolved itself properly, and we've got really morons teaching it at the moment. Okay, Newton pointed natural philosophy in a new direction. He offered mathematical analysis anchored on inescapable empirical fact as a new foundation of rigorous account of the cosmos. From this perspective, it's like he really just jumped to an answer with, it's not that he just jumped, he just said, hang on, I don't have to use that, I can use God. You have to understand this. Yeah, just, you read his work and you get this point. From this perspective, the great error of both Aristotelian and the new mechanical natural philosophy was its failure to adhere strictly enough to empirical facts. Vortical mechanics, which is the idea that Descartes had, for example, claimed that matter was moved by the action of an invisible agent, yet this, the Newtonians began to argue, was not to explain what really happening, but to imagine a fiction that gives a speciously satisfactory rational explanation of it. However, we now know that, the Mexican hat, symmetry breaking of the Higgs boson means that matter is superconducting in our space. So go suck that, you people. I have to go back and study the Higgs particle again, but your Higgs boson is symmetry breaks and it can take any factor. And so while electrons can be superconducting in a superconductor, we're superconducting matter is superconducting in space, so it doesn't stop. I just have to go back. I sort of remember at the top of my head bits and pieces, but it's all scrambled. Sorry about that. But at least I know about it. Natural philosophy needs to resist the allure of the rational imaging and instead deal only with the empirical approval. I think that's a legitimate, if you're in the 18th century, that's a legitimate move, and it's a very successful move, but I don't think it's necessary nowadays. Moreover, the Newtonians argued, if a set of irrefutable facts cannot be explained other than by accepting the brute facticity of their truth, this is not a failure of philosophical explanation so much as a devotion to appropriate rigor. Oh God, that's as mad as hell. And the, my overall thing is that evil can get into anything. Such epistemological battles became especially intense around Newton's theory of universal gravitation. Few questioned that Newton had demonstrated the irrefutable mathematical laws whereby bodies appear to attract one another in relation to their masses, and inverse relation to the square of the distance between them. But was this rigorous mathematical, empirical description a philosophical account? Of the body's motion, I can tell you no, you need general relativity and Higgs particles. Critics such as Leibniz said no, since mathematical description was not the same thing as a philosophical explanation, and Newton refused to offer an explanation of how and why gravity operated by the way it did. The Newtonians countered that this phenomenal description was scientifically adequate so long as they were grounded in empirical facts, and since no facts had yet been discerned to explain what gravity is or how it works, no scientific account or is it yet possible. So look, we now live in a world of gravity waves, Higgs bosons, general relativities, go figure, it's all a big piece of trash. However, what I was going to say is, at this point in time, we've heard the volume as I was backing away a mosquito. This is dusk down here in good old Aussie land. What I was going to say is that the issue is that there were bad actors in each school. There's bad actors in the Newton school, bad actors in the other school. Since no facts had yet been discerned that explained what gravity is or how it works, no scientific account was yet possible. And this is the entire thing where you've been able to, and Einstein went a bit ahead and saying, well, let's look at what could have been possible. And so he had this empiricist rationalism. They further insisted that it was enough that gravity did operate in the way that Newton said it did, and this was its own justification for accepting his theory. Well, it's not a theory, it's a descriptive law. And they further mocked those who insisted on dreaming up chimeras like the celestial vortices as explanation of phenomena when no empirical evidence existed to support such theories. Well, this is really interesting. And I don't think you really need celestial vortices. But I think they're alright then. So this is interesting that Voltaire was really, you know, you teach a term of gravity of Newton, and you know, I'm just really struggling. I have to remember in my head now what has to be taught where and when. The previous summary describes the general core of Newtonian position in the intense philosophical context of the first decades of the 18th century. It also describes Voltaire carked it, was in 1776, something like that. I can't remember. It also describes Voltaire's own stance in these same battles. His contribution, therefore, is not centered on any innovation within these very familiar Newtonian themes. Rather, it was his accomplishments to become a leading evangelist for the new Newtonian epistemology, and by consequence a major reason for its widespread dissemination and acceptance in France and throughout Europe. A comparison with David Hume's role in the same development might be helped to eliminate the distinct contributions of each. Both Hume and Voltaire began with the same kind of scepticism about rationalist philosophy, and each embraced the Newtonian criterion that made empirical fact the only guarantee of truth in philosophy. Yet, Hume's target remained traditional philosophy, and his contribution was to extend the scepticism all the way to the point of denying the feasibility of transcendental philosophy itself. This argument would famously awake Kant's dogmatic slumber and lead to the reconstruction of transcendental philosophy in new terms, but Voltaire had a different fish to fry. His attachment was to the new Newtonian empirical scientists, and while he was never more than a dilettante scientist himself, his devotion to the form of natural inquiry made him, in some respects, the leading philosophical advocates of the ideologists in the new empirico-scientific conception of philosophy that Newton initiated. Now, I don't think he did, but Newton really didn't think it through as a philosophy, he just did it. For Voltaire, and it's really interesting because if Newton was actually hooked in intellectually to his world, he wouldn't have done any of the stuff, because he was just a bit, we might say a bit autistic. He just bumbled along. For Voltaire and many of the 18th century Newtonians, the most important project was defending empirical science as an alternative to traditional natural philosophy. And this involving sharing in Hume's critique of the abstract rationalist systems, but it also involved the very different project of defending empirical induction and experimental reasoning as the new epistemology, appropriate for the modern enlightened philosophy. In particular, Voltaire fought rigorously against the rationalist epistemology and critics used to challenge Newtonian reason. His famous conclusion in Candide, for example, that optimism was a philosophical chimera produced when dialectical reason remains detached from brute facts, owed a great debt to Newtonian convictions. His alternative offered in the same text of life devoted to simple tasks with clear, tangible, most importantly useful ends was also derived from the utilitarian discourse that the Newtonians also used to justify their science. Voltaire's campaign on behalf of smallpox inoculation, which began with his letter on the topic in the Letters Philosophiques, was similarly grounded on appeal to the facts of the case as an anecdote to fears generated by the logical deductions from the seemingly sound axiomatic principles. All of Voltaire's public campaigns, in fact, deployed empirical fact as the ultimate solvent for irrational prejudice with blind adherence to pre-existing understanding. In this respect, his philosophy, as manifest in each, was deeply indebted to the epistemological conviction he gleaned from Newtonianism. Okay, we'll finish it there, and we're off for episode 4 further down the track. Thanks a lot for listening. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.